of the University of Hawaii. This is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at CSEASHawaii.com.
Now, the Asian Studies program and the Center for Southeast Asian Studies and the Center for Korean Studies would like to welcome Dr. Patricia Ramnales, better known as JoJo, to present a topic called The Local in Philippine National History, Some Puzzles, Problems, and Options. I won't go through a whole litany of his publications and so on, just to summarize a few things. JoJo got his PhD at Cornell University. He is currently a professor of Philippine Comparative Politics and Philippine Studies at the Center for Southeast Studies at Kyoto. He also holds a BA from the University of the Philippines, Diliman, and he's taught for about 6 years at Ohio University in Southeast Asian politics. Currently, this particular year, he is a Woodrow Wilson Fellow. And a few of the books that he's done, I'd like to mention a couple. One is called State and Society in the Philippines with Donna Amoroso. His wife. I think we have other mentions that I want to mention Daniel Bowers' name. But we do have husband and wife writing together, which is kind of nice. And the other book that he's written, there are many of them that he would like me to mention, is Making Mindanao, Katapato at the Bow and the Formation of the Philippine State. So without going further, I would like to welcome Dr. Patricia Ramnales to the
studio. Thank you. This is very. Thank you very much, Professor Ong Twin, for the kind introduction, and thank you for the Asian Studies faculty and the center, Philippine Studies, for inviting me here. It was a sort of a psychological. I just changed things psychologically because in DC everybody wears suits and ties. It took me 45 minutes to wear a necktie. And then everybody seems to be walking around, you know, with their power, with their blueberries, like, you know, saying, let's go invade Iraq now, you know. And so then you arrive in Honolulu, and like, everybody's laid back. So took me some time with the physical jet lag and the psychological to come here, but it's very nice to be here. I feel honored. It's nice to see people for the first time that you've read. It's also great to see people you haven't seen for 30 years. Professor Santiago was in the University of Philippines when I was there as a young kid. They inspired us with our activism. No, it was a lecture. She was one of the uprising faculty. And I haven't seen Lilia for 30 years. And it's really nice. She hasn't changed. Same old feisty Lilia Santiago. Okay, so I prepared, I think, a 45-minute presentation, and I hope I won't bore you with this. But let me start by saying that this presentation is about questions I've been thinking about in my 30 years of studying the Philippines, which have led me to, at least at this point, and I hope to agitate you on this, to consider that the writing of Philippine national or nationalist history may be next to impossible. Okay. Let me lay this out to you by way of three stories. The first is in 2002, in a symposium at the University of the Philippines on the American military presence on the Muslim zones of Mindanao Island in the southern Philippines. It was pretty obvious that the organizers saw it as another forum to, quote-unquote, blast away at U.S. imperialism. However, the invited and very respected Muslim intellectual, Pa'abud Said Linga, who has been denied twice coming from this country, prevented from coming to this country, actually, unexpectedly went off script when asked about how the Bangsamoro view the American presence in Mindanao. And he said in Taglish, that is not sellable to the Moros. Sa Pilipinos yan, hindi naman sa Moro, which meant this is a problem for Filipinos, not the Muslims. The forum then took a different turn after the sponsors' interest in forging solidarity with the Bangsamoro comrades began to wane. The second story comes from a farewell speech by Joel Rocamora, the outgoing president of the left-wing party-list organization Akbayan. Rocamora made this unusual admission of an organizational problem shortly after the 2008 elections. He said, and I quote, "After detailed, careful, highly participatory analysis of this debacle, everyone united around the conclusion that the party-list system had been successfully subverted by old political clans. What was supposed to be a national contest had been broken up into many local contests. Ironically, our party-list vote declined because we had devoted too much attention to the national party-list campaign and not enough to local electoral outcomes contests. Party-list elections also determined our organizational strategy and in the end exposed the widespread, nationwide, but shallow character of our party structures. Now, Rocamora's warning came after Akbayan lost a number of city and town seats in the areas where the party thought it had done solid organizing. The third story is more personal. I visited my mother in northwestern in Ozamby City, a small, really dull city, boring city in northeastern Mindanao, last January 2004. And as part of the family reunion, we normally went to the beach resort nearby. The other guests at that resort were subalterns of a certain provincial boss who was then serving a life sentence for raping a 13-year-old girl. And he was released and he became congressman in the next election. This recent elections. In Manila, President Gloria Arroyo had just survived a mutiny by young military officers, and the capital was rife with stories of her impending political demise, especially after Arroyo, now extremely unpopular, reneged on her promise not to run as president. But at this provincial resort, the upbeat conversations of the ward chiefs belied Manila's gloom and doom. Over beers and coconut wine, the jefes bragged about that the network had been set up in this and other provinces. Arroyo's victory was in the bag, and talks of another coup or an impeachment were all sound with no bite. And sure enough, Arroyo was elected the following May. I'll explain the quote later. These three stories provide striking and perhaps disturbing evidence to the extent to which national politics is shaped and determined by the local. Pa'abud's rebuff of the nationalist script reaffirms the enduring story of Muslims' non-identification with the Philippines. Rocamora's plaint about Akbayan's inability to challenge local and warlord power represents a signal shortcoming of the country's ideological and programmatic movements. And the Dipolog powwow, the resorts in Dipolog, gives us an idea to the extent to which local politics determine national outcome. Yet, and here's the puzzle, these powerful influences have rarely been given due by historians of the nation. The Muslims, for example, the most exploited and most militant of all local communities, but the only local community in the Philippines which had a political authority before colonial rule, merit a mere 13 pages in the seminal textbooks of the country's foremost historians. Excuse me, 4 pages in Teodoro Agoncillo's 1975 edition, The History of the Filipino People, and 9 pages in Renato Constantino's extremely popular 2-volume work, The Philippines, A Past Revisited, and A Continuing Past. Now, how did this come to be? Let me venture 2 reasons that I hope could invite further discussions. The first was obvious, data. Okay? If you use the present artificial administrative divisions of the country as a starting point, 82 provinces, 135 cities, 1,493,000 municipalities to boot, you get an idea of how difficult the process of writing and integrating would be. Add to this the fact that when these books were written, Agoncillo's and Guerrero's and Constantino's, access to provincial archives and resource persons were very difficult. In 75, 76, it was next to impossible to go to the Moro zones. There was a war going on. On the other hand, professors like Professor Santiago at the time, we were poorly paid. We had no money. Finally, as in other recently independent countries, local histories were not yet well documented. Now, these are not insignificant trifles that we can simply dismiss. Empirical substance is, after all, what makes any analysis or argument credible. But then there was also bias. Notwithstanding his portrait as a pro-people historian, Agoncillo saw Philippine history as determined in Manila and its aura emanating into the provinces, although stopping short of the foot of the Cordillera Mountains and probably not going beyond his home province of Batangas. A closer examination of his other works shows that he gave equal attention to national revolutionaries and national state leaders like the irascible Manuel Quezon, the Commonwealth president who was famous for saying that the Philippines would rather be governed like hell by Filipinos than like heaven by Americans. Quezon was notable for having strengthened the central state and having tried to govern autocratically. As a sidebar, as one of Agoncillo's last students in his last class, he actually was famously silent during the first days of the Marcos dictatorship. And this was, we think, in part motivated by his secret desire that Marcos succeed where Quezon failed. In contrast to Agoncillo, Constantino amassed considerable data on the provinces and devoted space to what he called the people's movements. But his class perspective gave minimal value to local dynamics. He assumed that the local class uprisings out there in the provinces were putative or actual expressions of a nationalist awakening that would eventually reach a qualitative transcendence and turn into a national force. At the other end of the political spectrum, he saw the feudal lords, his Marxian description of provincial families, as representatives of a national elite, not power holders, whose main concern was their coercive control over their domains. Thus, Constantino did not analyze local stories as reflections of the political economy and social life of their localities, much less attempt to incorporate these such meanings into his nationalist narrative. There were, of course, efforts in the 1970s to correct this imbalance. Some of Agoncillo's students began to focus and teach courses on local history. I was one of the beneficiaries of this shift, producing what we saw were preliminary works on the beginnings of the provinces north of Manila and Muslim Mindanao. Other historians, notably the late Walter Henry Scott, wrote on the early histories of the northern territories of Luzon Island. My problem, however, with this work is that, like Constantino, they read local narratives as part of the national story and assume that eventually they would eventually be added into the national frame. Samultan's first book, for example, The Filipino-Muslim Struggle, 1900 to 1972, which was published in 1977, saw no difference between the way the Muslims resisted the Americans and the Philippine state and the nationalist rebellions in the South. But there were significant differences between these acts of anti-resistance, to which I will return momentarily. Other scholars, especially after those writing when Marcos fell, also chimed in. Two of the astounding studies I think you're familiar with Alfred McCoy's An Anarchy of Families and John Seidel's Capitalism, Coercion, and Crime, explain the foundations of oligarchic power, the way in which local political economies brought about warlord and clan's political families, who then establish and nurtured patronage ties with national elites. But again, the problem is, and perhaps intentionally, the problem with these works is that they tend to be inward looking, and as if McCoy, Al, and John Seidel suggesting to us that the only way we can treat the Philippines is to look at it as essentially a collection of local stories. The only interesting deviation from the script in McCoy's book is the one by the Cebuano historian Rizal Mujares, who tracked the history of the Osmeña family from Cebu and the attempts of the children to put in a president or a vice president. But none of the other essays in the book explore the analogous process and ask which featured local bosses, clans, and warlords had the makings of a national elite. Perhaps this is understandable since there was little evidence of such formation. And what evidence there was clearly showed that even if elected nationally, what mattered at the end of the day was the spoils to be procured to strengthen provincial local power. The other interesting thing, book actually was one that McCoy and Ed Jesus edited. It's titled, I'm sure you're familiar with it, Philippine Social History, Global Trade and Local Transformation. It's an interesting book in the sense that Al and Ed Jesus said, you have to treat the Philippines as a series of societies. Okay? Some which had stronger linkages to the world capitalist economy than with Manila. They're in fact saying that what formerly constitutes the Philippine jail body was a series of very fragile ties. Or to put it differently, some of these societies have histories that may not fit the national historical frame. And so the more you write about them, the more you realize how wide the gap is between these two tales. And how difficult then was writing these stories vis-a-vis and putting them alongside the national or the attempted national narrative. Let me show you some of these inconsistencies when we look at the way Philippine history has been explained. This is one of the reasons why it took us so long to write our book. My wife and I had shouting matches at 2 o'clock in the morning as we walked back from the university to Kyoto on how to interpret people like Quezon. So, for example, the 1896 revolution, which started the collapse of the Spanish Empire in the Philippines, was the catalyst that people called the birth of the nation. But was soon, as one of the historian Flor Cuboyan said, aborted by the arrival of the Americans. Many of the Filipino leaders who participated in that revolution against Spain surrendered when it became clear that they could not compete militarily and politically against the new colonizers. Historians refer to this collaboration as having sold out the nation, but what is often ignored is how much of that collaboration was motivated by local interests. Let me just give you two examples. It was particularly noticeable in the case of the regional elites like the Negros families, the families where Professor Trimelos came from, the region, not the province, the province. They were more interested in establishing their own republic than joining the National Revolutionary Government of President Emilio Aguinaldo. The only American firepower, the promise of sharing in local governance, won them over to the new colonial framework. Equally interesting were the resistance by the various Muslim groups, who been for the last 250 years were on the offensive against the Spanish state, and who only lost the Spaniards in the last years of colonial rule. Muslim defiance against the Americans again ended when the Datus, the traditional leaders, joined the colonial state for the same reason the Negros families did, helped along the way by American assurances that they would be protected from the rapaciousness of the Filipino caciques. One of the reasons why I decided to go back to history, I'm a political scientist formally, but one of the reasons why I decided to shift my research for my dissertation to history was when I interviewed this wonderful 92-year-old man in Cotabato in 1990. His granddaughter introduced me as, this is Jojo Abinales, he's from Northern Mindanao, he's Visayan, but he's studying in America. So the old man turned to me and said, a slave. I said, yes. And then he said, a slave in America. I said, yes. And I said, so when is General Leonard Wood coming back to save us from the Filipinos? And that's when I realized that, there's a different process and dynamic going on here. I'll come back to that later. So the standard narrative ignores the fact that these local elites lived outside the framework of the Spanish colonial state. As a piece in Philippine social history describes the sugar industry as a direct link to the British-dominated global economy. It meant then that the Negros families saw themselves less as nascent Filipinos and more as global citizens. The long failure of the Spanish state to subjugate the Moros meant that the Maguindanaos, the Maranaos, the Tausug's destinies continued to be dictated by the ups and downs of an older political economy centered in the trade of goods and humans within maritime Southeast Asia and between that region and the Chinese and British empires. Thank you, Professor Andaya. In short, these Muslim communities had more affinities with Malay communities in British Malaya and Dutch Java. They were Southeast Asians. They were not Filipinos. We must ironically credit the Americans for preventing this evolving breakup of the Spanish colonial society and for imposing a stable and pliant colonial frame that brought this series of societies together. But this was achieved not through a decisive, direct intervention by the colonial state, but by through compromises and accommodations with local elites. These local elites' interests were also protected in Manila through the most locally oriented of all national institutions, the Philippine Assembly. which historian Bonifacio Salamanca refers to as, quote, the matrix which real Philippine autonomy evolved. It's still the same now. So the Americans, however, never saw this as a contradiction, except for the importance they place on public education and a professional civil service, which historian Audie Corpus examined. They faithfully actually implemented President McKinley's guideline that says the distribution, quote, the distribution of power among governments organized by the Philippine Commission should have as its presumption to favor always smaller divisions. And he ordered, in part of his guide, order said, the example of distribution of powers between the United States and the national government and of national government of the United States should be the model, and where no direct administration will be implemented except of matters of purely general concerns. In short, the American imperial adventure was local, profoundly local in character. Actually, so in the archives, fascinating stories of the deputy secretary of state really acting like a secretary. There are like five people in there. We see this in the state militias that comprise the Expeditionary Army, the state-based politicians who manage top offices. William Howard Taft was from Ohio. He saw the Philippines from the prism of spoils machine politics in Ohio. And we see state-based politicians who manage top offices, and even the first American capitalists to set up shop in Manila and places like Zamboanga City. They were local hicks. Progressivism, that ideological movement in the early 20th century that was associated with, among other things, a strong federal state, an autonomous national bureaucracy, remained a faint ideal in this colonial adventure. It was limited to army proconsuls who were in charge of the Moro province, and as Jerry Finnan wonderfully put it, the Cordilleras, and those who were concerned with professionalizing the colonial service. In fact, the first encounters between Filipino elites and American colonial officials were facilitated by both sides' provincial. They were all provincial. They were not imperial mindsets. And they found a very little difference in the way they viewed each other. So Colonel Banholz would refer to Manuel Quezon as, you know, little Manny. And Banholz was always perceived by Quezon not as a representative of the empire, but as this very powerful local constabulary chief. So for the Americans, the turn of the century was like building yet another state, perhaps the 51st state of the Union, although this time with no assurance of its integration. So I think here lie the institutional and political basis for the failure of our elites to develop a sense of nation. President Quezon was aware of this drawback when he became head of the Commonwealth, and he sought to strengthen central state power agencies like presidency and the military, both to promote his own ambition and to bring the nascent political clans under his control. World War II interrupted this grand project. And after the war, the Republic reverted to its decentralized politics and the nationally ambitious won power through patronage-driven coalitions in the regions and provinces. It would take another 28 years until another president tried to do what Quezon failed to do, and this time in competition with the Communist Party that was able to overcome the limitations of its predecessors. And both of these projects, I propose it, were both national plans to finally bring about national unity, failed. So now I'd like to discuss briefly Marcos. He's a very funny guy. The centralization of state power under Marcos did suppress many local elite families. It's been always portrayed as the high point of centralization, the high point of national state power. And there was evidence for that. And I was in 1973, 74, I was a sophomore in college when the war began in Mindanao. That was the first time I saw the National Army. The coercive powers of the national state visited our lazy hometown. But what was really examined is how Marcos consolidated his regime and the involvement of pro-Marcos political clans and families in that consolidation. For example, at the height of the Moro National Liberation Front rebellion, the separatist rebellion in the South, it was not simply the AFC's battlefield successes that led to the stalemate of 1977-78. In fact, part of the reason why the MNLF was not able to expand in areas that they were targeting was because of the resistance by warlords like the very fascinating Muhammad Ali de Maporo, who claimed that his own private armies played a very big role in stopping the expansion of the MNLF. and the thereby preventing the influence of Muslim separatism to spread among the other communities. Provinces, for example, that the regime deemed critical for its patrimonial plunder were handed to loyal strongmen who were to be left alone by national development planners. Such was the case in the banana and coconut industries in Mindanao, which became the more major sources of plunder by the Marcoses and the likes of Roberto Benedicto, Antonio Floirendo, and Eduardo Huango. There is now, with this friends of ours at the University of the Philippines has completed a project interviewing all the Marcos technocrats. They're all dying, so they want to set their record straight. Thank God. There were two things that were very interesting in their comment. They're very professional, technocratic. Talk about it. First, they hated what Imelda did to them. The first lady always raised the budget. But the other thing, what Marcos told them is not to touch this basic industries, because my fraternity brothers and my cronies are there. So we know what happened to the coconut industry, which precipitated the rise of the Communist Party in Mindanao, but also with the sugar and banana industries, which also led to the expansion of the communist movement in the Negros areas. But in bailiwicks also, where anti-Marcos forces were in control, like Cebu, the dictatorship gave local allies like the dreaded warlord Ramon Dorano and the Gullius family a free hand in running their domains. Such that in 1978, when Marcos had to show a series of demonstration elections, Carter was in power, that he was constitutional and he respected human rights, he would rely mainly on his political allies and clans to bring in the votes. Okay, in Lanao del Sur, it's very famous, that the birds and the bees will vote for Marcos. Even the dead will rise up and, courtesy of Ali de Mapolo, go vote for Marcos. So it's like you have actually certain towns in Lanao del Sur where the percentage is like 120% returns of ballots, you know. So neither did, and it's happened again, November 2008 elections, neither did anti-Marcos politicians disappear at the scene, okay? While they were deprived of their patronage resources and of their private armies, they were able to survive by reaching out to an unlikely ally, the Communist Party. In certain areas, they even became patrons of the New People's Army, the Communist Guerrilla Army, protecting them from rival groups and hiding them from the military. And despite the foreboding presence of warlords like Dorano and Golias, anti-Marcos politicians won in 78 and 80 in Cebu, and oppositionists also won in Misamis Oriental in northern Mindanao. And Zamboanga, one of the oppositionists who won is a guy named Cesar Climaco. Somebody, you know, one of the young students should study him because he was a wonderful crackpot. In 1978, he filed the candidacy of his pig against Marcos, and the pig almost won. You know. But the most important indicator that local power was never completely obliterated by the dictatorship was its speedy comeback once Marcos fell from power. And in the first national elections, a year after Corazon Aquino took over the presidency, the same Cebuano historian, Resil Mujares, wrote this very beautiful observation. And I'd like to quote it. The result of the 11 May 1987 election show that out of 200 congressmen in the House of Representatives, 130 belong to the so-called traditional political families. 86, 1 year after EDSA. Well, another 39 are relatives of these families. Only 31 have no electoral record prior to 1971 and are not directly related to these old dominant families. Of the 169 congressmen who are members of or are related to dominant families, 102 are identified with pre-1986, meaning Marcos, anti-Marcos forces, while 67 are from pro-Marcos parties or families. Despite a few non-traditional figures among the 24 elected members of the Senate, the cast is largely made up of persons belonging to prominent pre-1972 political families. Since then, local power has dominated post-Marcos politics, provided additional institutional resources and power by the Local Government Code of 1991, which provided, among other things, the return of 40% of internal revenues collected from the provinces to the provinces, and the devolution of selected national, of majority of national executive agencies. The largesse of many of these families and warlords would be filled up by the earnings coming from a now nationwide illegal numbers game, wetting, and the constant inflow of methamphetamines, heroin, ecstasy tablets, and even illegal rice into the provinces. I used to have this, tell this story. Our local mayor, he lost last year. And this year, he loved, in Osami City, he's the son of an anti-communist vigilante group. He loves to save the mangrove forest, but my hometown is also where illegal rice from Vietnam come in. And my hometown is also the seat where the top heroin from Hong Kong and Xiamen are brought in. Escorted, of course, by the Philippine Navy. And Coast Guard. So my mother used to say, well, these ships coming in, you know, it's in Philippine flag, and they speak a different language. And said, Mom, that's Vietnamese. And the wonderful thing about this mayor is that every time I go home in December, she'd call me and say, come here, you're the professor. What do we do with the mangroves? Should I apply for ADB, money from the Asia Development Bank? I said, yes, sir. You know, how you cannot say no because it's, you know, huge bodyguards with their Armalite rifles in front of you. So if you actually get a chance, you should get Al McCoy's new book on the history of the Philippine police. Because it gives part two of the book, the vision, a staggering account of how the illicit sector around the Philippines has become dominant in the economy. Some say 50% of the GDP of the country come from the sale of these banned commodities and from wetting. So you cannot win political power now unless you become friends with the illegal numbers game guy. So with these powers and wealth behind them, the local elites has easily derailed any attempt to weaken them. The land reform law has been diluted, and the anti-dynasty bill has failed to pass Congress. Presidents have promised to declare war on drugs, Estrada, strengthen the capacities of the national state, Ramos, or even establish a strong republic, Arroyo, would at the end of the day compromise themselves because the provinces brought in the votes during crisis moments supported them against populist and democratic opponents. And when they did try to challenge local power, as Estrada did when he ordered the assassination of one of Northern Luzon's notorious warlords and wetting lords, Luis Chavit Singson, they were ousted in the name of democracy. Singson, after Arroyo came to power, after the ouster of Estrada and the ascension to Arroyo's power, arose through the ranks and was, at the end of Arroyo's term, officially designated the Deputy National Security Advisor of the President. He wouldn't proceed. There were stories of him beating up the girlfriend or whatever. Let me make a brief comment on President Arroyo. She actually is a very fascinating president in the sense that she's the first polyglot president we've ever had. She scolds her husband in Spanish. She speaks fluent Cebuano, which is why my mother voted for her. But she can also speak Ilocano, Pampanga, Pangasinenses, a little Ilongo. Yeah, it's Spanish. And Kapampangan, yes, Kapampangan, eight languages. Her critics have always emphasized her unceremonious exit. The joke then was that if the president of Indonesia was Megawati, she was Miniwati. You know, and they have horrible, big, fat, horrible, corrupt husbands. You know. But what they have failed to explain, what these critics have failed to explain, is how this immensely disliked person survived two impeachment attempts, two military mutinies, and a national election. Arroyo's power, in fact, lay with her intimate links with the provinces, her shrewd move to keep local governments their share of the national tax revenue, and in certain instances, rescue provincial governments from their fiscal deficits, proved very well in keeping people, the governors and mayors, to her side, and the cousins, wives, and husbands in the lower house of Congress in power to prevent all this impeachment against her. Her two strongest and most durable alliances was with Singson in the north and other wetting operators, including the current governor of Pampanga province, and with the brutal Ambatuan family in the south. The latter alliance is particularly notable. Under the Ampatuans, actually, the Muslim zones in Mindanao were at its most stable since the 2000 war between the MILF and the Philippine Army. The Ampatuans kept the peace by paying off their rivals, as they did in 2008. The San did not have no opponents when he ran as governor of the autonomous region for Muslim Mindanao because all the opponents were paid $50 million each. And when the rivals refused to be bribed, they were all eliminated, as what happened last November 2009. Only the careless decision of the old man to approve the massacre of a caravan of media people and members of the rival Mangundadato family broke their control. And with it, Arroyos controlled the Muslim zones. Because where did she get her 1 million votes in 2004? The rumor then, I was actually there a month before the massacre, and the rumor then was the Ampatuans kept the three teachers who filled up the ballots. So there were only three teachers with the same signatures filled up the ballots for the 1 million votes. And when the army raided the families, these towers, you know, castles in this really small town. The first thing they went after were not the money and the guns, which eventually what was reported in media, they were ordered to look for the ballots and put it in the rain and let it rain. And the rain disappeared. And then the army then brought in the media and said, okay, let's look for the guns and the money. But take note, in the last election, this year's election, 12 of the 15 Ampatuans who ran for political office, local mayors and towns, won. And Arroyo herself would end her term as president and take the seat of representative of the 2nd District of Pampanga in the lower house of Congress. Let me just skip. I'll skip the Communist Party and just go straight to Linga because I have time. So, which brings me to the comments of Said Linga, okay? And it's rebuffed the UP intellectuals' anti-imperialism. I pointed out earlier how fraught the Muslims' relationships have been with the rest of the countries, dominated as this were by the politics of patronage and the power of guns, guns, and gold to benefit local national actors and local allies. But there was another threat, actually, that Abud's answer suggested, and this is resilient pro-American sentiment among many Muslim communities. In fact, in 2002, a survey was done of Muslims asking whether they were in favor of American military presence in Mindanao, and 60% said yes. Okay. You still go around Marawi now, and if you're an American, they would say, hey, when is the next president, proposal to turn us into the 51st state of the union. Okay, and this approbation cuts across classes and political forces. They range from the late Basilan warlord, Governor Wahab Akbar, who declared that he could die 10 times after watching the American troops build a series of roads in his province, and a few years later he was car-bombed. The publicly it's supposed to be by his rival, but in Basilan they always say, no, it's the wives, they killed him, he must become, you know, three wives of hers, of his. Now one is the governor, the other is the mayor, the other is the representative. That gives you a power of women. The late chairman of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, Hasim Salabat, who in 2003 wrote a letter to the United States and President Bush asking for the Americans, the United States and Malaysia to mediate peace talks between the Philippine government and the MILF. And of late, and this has been my research, the former MNLF combatants who are participating enthusiastically in USAID's growth with equity in Mindanao's livelihood projects. They always say, you know, if you're American, you don't get kidnapped in Mindanao. Okay? Japanese, yeah, we'll kidnap you. But you know, the American, USAID is very good to us, so you can go in and out. Now, Manila's nationalists always say, often silent about this phenomenon. Although some of my Marxist friends at UP always say, well, it's false consciousness, you know. But I think such a patronizing explanation does not help us understand the dynamics of Muslim opposition to meaningful integration to the Philippines and the Sicilian pro-Americanism in probably the only Muslim society in the world. I try to explain this historically in my book, Making Mindanao. Because one of the things that I sort of, I told you about that Leonard Wood story, was very pervasive. The American army really believed that they would separate Mindanao from the rest of the Philippines, protect the Muslims from the Filipinos, and if and when General Leonard Wood became president, this is what the guy said, they would come back and save them from the Filipinos. What happened was, after that, the Muslim elites got integrated into the colonial state, and like any other provincial state, decided to play patronage politics with national leaders, beginning with Manuel Quezon. And this kind of mutual accommodation would last through the colonial period and up to the eve of martial law. So unsurprisingly, Muslim voices were important only when the delivery of votes was being negotiated during elections, like much the Ilocano voice, the Visayan votes, you know. And outside of elections, these communities were generally ignored by their leaders, their welfare often the last of their slaughter's concern, which is why the Muslim zones in Mindanao are the poorest in the country. In some cases, they are even disparaged by their leaders. I found this wonderful quotation from the late Muslim Senator Salipada Pendaton, who said, publicly, my people are still ignorant. They are not in consonance with the progress of civilization. They are, in fact, the most backward and illiterate minority group in the country today. They feel like they are second-class citizens. Whether right or wrong, that is their feeling. But what is wrong would be to force them to reject and keep rejecting changes for the betterment of life. And Adi, he said, like sanitation and health services. Certainly not our customs and traditions, because those are things we would never let go. But they must change in order to be able to participate and help in the country's progress. Until such time, Muslims have no right to ask for equal justice. He said this in 1971, when young Muslim intellectuals were making a breakthrough organizing the Moro National Liberation Front. In effect, Pendaton and a lot of his fellow politicians, Muslim politicians, were trying to forestall the politicization and perhaps even the democratization of these communities, which were in the process of uniting to separate from the Philippines, 1971. Now, so that the only two political authorities with some positive resonance to the Ummah have therefore been the resistance groups today, the MNLF and the MILF, which fought and defended the community against the Philippine state, and the American army, which a century ago, also promised them the same thing. Where Filipinos enter this picture, they do so as allies of traditional elites or representatives of the state's coercive apparatus, the army. There are actually certain communities, villages in Maguindanao province, where they, up until 1996, the only Filipino they saw was a person in uniform. Okay, so they were always surprised when you have, oh, you're not in uniform. Yes, I am a historian. I'm not a soldier in the army. No wonder then that the collective memory of Muslims values the American presence in Mindanao, both in the past and today. So, can anything mitigate the centrifugal four processes? I'm on the last phase now. And bear with me. And create more positive attachment. What could constitute a frame for writing a more inclusive and broader national history? How will we go about doing this? I tell Professor Aquino yesterday, Commander Lindy, that I'm schizophrenic now. Today I'm for the separation of Mindanao. Tomorrow, let's integrate the Philippines again. Sincerely, it's been bothering me for the last 30 years. Well, perhaps what we can do is to explore more what is happening outside metropoles like Manila, to give serious attention again to what Macoy and De Jesus write, but also bear in mind what the late historian Oliver Walters said, that in treating the communities of Southeast Asia, we should look at them as centers in themselves, with their own important connections with hubs other than their capitals. So in my own specific area of study, for example, there is for me the need to explore the connections of Mindanao Island have had with the rest of Southeast Asia during and after colonial rule. And one thing that I found out when I was in Tawi-Tawi province 2 months ago, this was very evident. People in Bongao, Tawi-Tawi, which is the southernmost island province in the Philippines, always refer to Malaysia as Indonesia over there. Okay. Malaysia over there. Yeah. And the trade with Malaysians is not smuggling, it's barter. But when you talk to them about Manila, they say, oh, it's a very faraway place. And the most wonderful assurance they gave me, they told the professors this yesterday, was when I was trying to say, where do I put my belongings? I said, oh, you can put them anywhere. I said, why? There's no Filipinos here. I'm like, okay. And then a friend of mine who has been doing research there five years ago said, well, there's a small island called Simuno where 364 days of the year they're all Malaysians. But they become Filipinos on one day, then they have to vote. So the rest of the day, they're Malaysian. And one of the wonderful things, for example, working with some of these Filipino staff in USAID in Mindanao, is like two drivers, for example, were fluent in Bisayan, Maguindanao, Maranao, Tausug, Filipino, English, and Bahasa. And I said, wow, how did you learn that? Oh, I was, you know, an illegal worker in Sandakan for 5 years. So go back and forth. It's a completely different world when you're there, you know. But this is not unique to Mindanao. The northernmost provinces of Luzon, for example, are said to have vibrant ties with South China and even southern Japan, where, you know, this cars chop-chop and stolen in Yokohama ended up in Subic Bay, courtesy of Russian ships, you know. One can also see this in the transnational linkages and the connections of the Filipino diasporas in places like Hawaii, not Manila, but there are where they have links with their home provinces. You know, and I've never been to Ilocos until 2004. But the one thing that really attracted me most was the arcs. You know, and when you go into the village and it says, you know, donated by Mr. So and So of Honolulu, Hawaii. You know, but you'll never see this in Manila or Cebu. In the metropoles, you know, say, you know, donated by, you know, Professor Lindy Aquino, Filipino. In short, then, the quest to write a more balanced nationalist history should see Philippine scholars going more comparative and regional, but also looking at the Philippines not only in terms of its colonial legacies, but its regional moorings. This, for example, could be found or rediscovered by studying hitherto unstudied areas like the informal economy, where human and commodity flows operate below the radar of the nation state surveillance, immigration, and tax agencies. When I was growing up in Mindanao, my concept of smuggled goods were Chinese toothpaste, Cadbury chocolates, Indonesia and Malong, and the Belgian rifle. Because my mother had her favorite Maranao smuggler. I said, oh, mom, we just got this from Singapore. Try this. And my cousin who grew up in Manila, her concept of smuggled goods were Boone's Farm, M&M's, Levi's. The textile industry wasn't outsourced then. And the Armalite rifle, because she lived near the American military base. And so I think what Jose Rizal called the El Demonio de las Comparaciones, which Ben Anderson subsequently made popular, is possibly the only way out of what Filipinos popularly call a crab mentality, and which historians see as the centrifugal forces that prevent the full birth of the nation. On the other hand, national-local bonds can also be re-examined this way. For example, the nationalization of television in the last 20 years or so, and the substantial time given to quote-unquote provincial efforts in news coverage have enhanced the corporeality of the Philippine imagined community. There is now more reportage on Mindanao, and critical updates from the provinces are found readily in prime time. In the other direction, Tagalog has become truly a national language, even though it's television Tagalog. We used to refer to it as ABS-CBN Tagalog. Recall, for example, that when he was interviewed on national and international television, the late Galib Andang, a.k.a. Commander Robot, one of the leaders of the commander of the Abu Sayyaf, spoke in Tagalog, not in Tausug, nor in English. Another bond, ironically, and this is painful at least for me, is the outcome of the wars of the 1970s, the Separatist War in 1970. In 2008, the Philippine Human Development Report tracked the plight of internally displaced Muslims. One trend it observed was the spread of Muslim communities beyond Mindanao, to even as far as Baguio City in the north. There are now 40 mosques in Manila alone, while trade in pirated DVDs and other illicit commodities are bringing Maranao and Tausug communities in contact with Filipinos throughout the archipelago. I have my favorite DVD pirate in Metro Walk in Manila. It's owned by Chavit Singson. And I always get a discount because I say, I'm from Mindanao. Like, okay, for 75 pesos, bless you. And they send me. So Muslim separatism therefore confronts the major obstacle of its constituents leaving the homeland and becoming, shall we say, more Filipino. Finally, there is the OFW phenomenon. B. Every conversation in e-group discussion contains a thread about Filipinos living and working abroad, becoming more aware of their being Filipino. Ben Anderson calls this long-distance nationalism, where he says members of the diaspora communities continue to identify themselves with the homeland and compensate with an exaggerated sense of pride for the country they come from through, among other things, quote, the power of new technologies in their possession. So in Japan, for example, you know, the Filipino community, it's quite powerful. When I started there in 2000, we used to go to Tokyo and go to mass in the Jesuit school church in Waseda, Sophia University. And every time you go out, the outside of Sophia, of the church, it becomes a little divisoria. Everybody's selling, and you know, the latest DVD, pirated DVD from Manila, you know, Minudo, you know, that's where you pick up your food. A few years after, the non-Filipino Catholics complained, there's traffic, you know, and so the police kicked them out. In 2008, we went back there because my wife moved to Yokohama. So let's go, you know, see where they sell there, and they were back. So I said, Manang, why are you back? I said, oh, don't worry, we won't. He said, will you be kicked out again? He said, don't worry, we married one of the policemen. We're okay now. So that is sort of like, we Filipinos can act together and unite, you know. And I really love it. It's such a wonderful experience to be abroad. And all these point to new and alternative forms of national attachments. Of course, there are impediments, no? More Filipinos now speak Filipino, but academics back home actually have discovered that Filipino is still strongly resisted as a medium instruction in non-Tagalog studies areas. I used to brag to my mother when I called her. She says, hey, your nephew and niece is slowly failing in Filipino. We are 75 in Filipino, they might fail. I said, we're Visayans. Of course we will fail Filipino. My father never spoke Tagalog. I understand Tagalog by watching Joseph Estrada, Fernando Poe in the movies. And my nephews and nieces watch ABS in Tagalog. But studies have also show that learning outcomes are compromised when children's mother tongue is abruptly dropped off from formal education. Many experts at the University of the Philippines now are proposing that elementary schools adopt a bilingual approach, teaching our children their language / dialect of birth and in Filipino to enhance their learning. Local identities are also resilient and do not necessarily dissolve in a larger solution. While Muslims are better distributed all over the archipelago in places like Metro Manila, especially this new urban poor community near the House of Representatives, they have not actually become more integrated or accepted, preferring to live in enclaves that are further subdivided into ethno-linguistic groups. Likewise, OFWs like me may have our long-distance nationalism mitigated by a fascinating, this one I observe in Japan, I don't know if it's happening here, by a lack of interest in national affairs. For example, in Japan, people talk of Filipinos in Japan, but none of these Filipinos actually have left Tokyo. I mean, I live in Kyoto. The Filipinos in Tokyo have never been there because it's expensive. But a lot of them, fascinatingly, have never been to Manila except when they have to file for a passport. So it's Davao, Manila get the passport, Tsukuba. It's my daughter, you know. For her, Manila is a hotel. The latter is often ignored or understood through the prism of the town, the city, the province, or the region, not the nation. So hence, the Los Angeles Filipino Club, or the Asociaciones de los Filipinos de Roma, or the Kyoto Association of Pinoy Students, have to jostle for that public space with the Visayan Association of Honolulu, Los Dabawenos in Madrid, or the Samahang Ilocano ng Tsukuba Daigaku. And of course, the tendency for most Philams is to see going home, to retire, as heading back to their towns, their villages, their cities, not to the generic Inang Bayan. Okay. During periods of critical political conjunctures, like the EDSA Revolution, or of late the death of Cory Aquino and the election of her son, the exploration of more positive bonds can mitigate the snags. it becomes imperative then to explore them farther, and what could keep and explore what could keep the former from unraveling once the conjunctures like this pass. This has been a challenge to many an NGO or civil society leader, public intellectuals, friends back home, academics, public intellectuals and activists back home, especially friends of mine in Mindanao. And so I see no reason why scholars should not dip their fingers in finding a way out of this predicament. Thank you very much. Wait for 10 minutes.
Sisters.
I call it the Chicago phenomenon. To be elected to be president of the United States, you have to talk to the dailies, and you know. This part is, I think, it's colonial. But the other thing is that if you're serious about building national unity, if you're serious about writing about national history, you have to first acknowledge this. And to acknowledge that means actually this is a major obstacle to national unity. And the national leadership had, including people like Marcos, looked at the quote-unquote national regimes as standing on the foundation of these local elites. That even Marcos would say, okay, don't touch the banana industry, don't touch the coconut industry, that's Dandings. Do not touch the illegal guns in Cebu because the Duranos control that. Durano, I want my votes now to show America and the rest of the country that I have 80%, 99% of the votes of Filipinos in 1978. Can you provide that? So I think part of it is all presidents think of themselves as national leaders. That's the public face. But at the end of the day, Arroyo will still say, Chabit, where's my cut? You know, can Ilocos deliver the votes? And that was actually what was fascinating in that 2004 vacation I had in the Dipolog. Because they were really, and I said, you know, we joined all the science thing. So I actually said, you know, she's very unpopular there. Look at national TV, you know, the military is mad at her, the Marines about to leave Basilan and Zamboanga to fly into Manila. I said, nah, don't worry. It's all in the bag. And this sort of thing is something that we have to look at. On the one hand, that's the reality. You have to study that. On the other hand, if you're concerned about how the nation imagines itself, how the nation national story could be written, then you have to obviously reach that point to say, these are obstacles. They have to be shot. They have to be put to jail. You know, you have to take a hit waiting, you know? And that hasn't happened so far under Marcos and even with our powerful military. And I think that's the pain, but also the curiosity that we as work people interested in Philippine studies should further explore. I don't know if I'm able to answer.
One more comment. Let's turn your argument around and look at the series of local histories that have been written, right? Mm. A lot of them. Now, can you say that there is no inclusion of nation in its local history?
No. And the classic, the Bengal, the natives of the area, don't worry, there are no Filipinos here.
Yeah.
That's very classic. I mean, so that's why I was saying I have this schizophrenic, sometimes I say Mindanao should separate from the Philippines. After all, we're not Filipinos. The next day I get pained about the fact that, you know, if I do that, I won't be, you know, drinking coffee with you without my visa, Professor Aquino. It's actually something that any meaningful scholar that tries to figure out the Philippines, it is weird history, have to deal with, and I have no answer for that. I've been trying to explore the OFW in Japan, but also looking at smuggling maybe as a source of unity. After all, we are all Southeast Asians. But I'm sorry, I haven't figured it out.
You mentioned Scott, and I think his work is excellent about Ilocano. American aggression.
Right.
I think what I'm talking about, where there are no boundaries of local individuals, thinking in terms of the contributions of the Ilocano movement to the nationalism.
No, I don't deny that. We had that. I mean, Michelle Morris' beautiful work on the Cubanos against America.
Problematic, you know.
The compromises that provincial elites entered into to become part of the nation. I mean, you have to read Scott alongside Finan, your person beside you. You cannot understand Scott now because the war, I mean, one of the things that stuck Filipino historians is they never go beyond the first decade of American rule. Everybody stops in 1896 and agonizes over Rizal. Okay, we don't have any history, comprehensive history of post-war republic yet.
Did you have your hand up, right?
Thank
you,
Jojo,
for that very stimulating.
You can answer, Lindy.
You talked about, like, in about Constantino and O.D. Corpus, but I wasn't clear in your presentation where you place O.D. in relation to those two, since his magnum opus came at a later date.
It's actually a very strange book. Goes as far, if you read it carefully, it goes as far as the 1930s, and then the rest is sped up, as if there's nothing happened within the Commonwealth and today. My suspicion is already confronted that problem. Okay, if you openly say, actually, you know, we really need a centralized state like Lee Kuan Yew did, that's the end of your story as a scholar. But it also, I think the other thing that Odie had a hard time dealing with was the national, what kind of national economy was emerging. Okay? Because the sugar industries were still connected to the U.S. and Britain. The South was still, you know, heavily into smuggling. There was really no national economy to think of. And Odie, like a lot of the Marcos technocrats, always thought in national terms. In fact, in these interviews with the technocrats under Marcos, what the first thing they bragged about was, this is 1970, okay? They were the first to conceive of a national development plan. In 1970, national development plan. And a lot of them discovered Mindanao and said, aha, riches, let's exploit it. Marcos, 1964, how many years after American War, was the first to say, we should integrate Mindanao into the national plan. Otherwise, nothing was happening. And there were enclaves like Del Monte Plantation in Bukidnon, but the rest of the island was impenetrable. So it's a very, very late 20th century phenomenon where you have these guys, from historians to technocrats to even activists, thinking of the nation for the first time. Unfortunately, as they started thinking about it in Mindanao, Muslim intellectuals are saying, hey, time to leave, baby, you know. Thank God for Nasser. Thank God for Iranian Revolution. We are going to leave. And this makes the country also very fascinating. Because the rest of Southeast Asia, you have regimes consolidating themselves, no? Except probably in southern Thailand. But the country was sort of late in the century was spring brought in. And there was in the 70s, the other thing that's fascinating about the 70s is like a big chunk of the middle class left. Went to Hawaii or Los Angeles. So the critical core of any national project, the middle class, suddenly said, goodbye, I'm driving California. or went to the mountains. Okay, became NPA guerrillas, spent 15 years in the jungle educating peasants, and by 1980 started killing each other. So this is so I have no answer. I have things with all these cases, it was like that. And now he's dying.
Yeah, this is maybe what you were just saying right now. I was going to say that if you compare Indonesia with the Muslims, what is interesting is that Indonesia was also separated into a large number of people, even more divided than the Philippines. And yet, the national project was very strong in Indonesia. And as a result, you see the nation really coalescing as a unit. Whereas the Philippines seem to have gone backwards. And what you're saying now is quite fascinating. Is that, you know, while you're talking about the 70s, things are starting to occur again. Maybe the Smashers project is re-emerging. And yet, when you talk about the elections, it's still the same thing that's going on.
Hmm.
What it seems to me the problem is the fact that people who are in the national as leaders are not thinking of the nation. They're talking about themselves. And therefore, they're maintaining these kinds of localizations,
right,
which have been undermined in Indonesia. And so now what you feel is that Indonesia is moving as a nation, but the Philippines is actually regressing.
Well, I think the president of the Philippines have always been schizophrenic, paranoid. Remember Quezon's last line? We found this wonderful line of Quezon when he was dying, and his followers were now jostling for position. He was dying in New York. And he said, how dare they say to them, I am Manuel Quezon, I am the Philippines. Okay? If you look at the Marcos diaries, the same thing. I am Marcos, I'm the Philippines. That's just one side. And I think there are political leaders who have the aspirations to unite. At the end of the day, however, they have to shift to Ilocano, to Kapampangan, to make sure that the support in the provinces remain, but also that the resources continue to flow. So that you have, actually, Arroyo is the fascinating president because she's the first one to speak all the national languages. Where she failed is, and this is the big problem in the Philippines, we have no national programmatic party other than the Communist Party of the Philippines. What is the classic line in the 60s? The Liberal Party and the National Party is like Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, you know. And this was, so that was a factor we never had. I mean, the military was weak, still weak, you know. And so it's there. And the only time the nation really got into an intense interaction with each other was in 1974. When for the first time, young Ilocanos, young Tagalogs, and Visayans were thrown in the middle, in the jungles of Maguindanao, and met Muslims. And the army became present. And that's one of the biggest irony, painful ironies of the country. Filipinos only began to meet each other in the 70s by killing each other. Mimi?
Yeah, I think I'll just follow up on some of the points right away. You know, I think it's somehow the conflation of, you know, local and national history and local and national politics, you know. And I think, you know, in terms of, for example, when you talk about national history and you talk about people like Agustino and Constantino, I mean, they were been trauma in a history of, you know, history from the 70s. And most historians now don't practice the type of nationalist or national narrative that they expect in that era. And, you know, you need to contextualize that in the 70s and 80s, you know, when they wrote that there was a kind of need for a national history because of, you know, or nationalist history because of martial law and all that. But you know, I mean, most historians now would not get away with writing same type of history, the same way they present history in the 70s.
Right, yeah, I agree.
And most historians focus on local history, they focus on local currencies, and people like the letter and then stuff, but I mean, they don't like the national narrative either, you know, and they've developed, you know, I mean, they've developed a lot of those histories. So I'm just talking about Philippine history profession.
The point is, letter is not a textbook.
Yeah, I mean,
you're talking about the intellectuals in Ateneo and the Liman in Loyola Heights.
In terms of the textbook, it's probably
true. And that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, well, it wasn't.
I mean, it's actually the textbooks have always been Constantino or Agoncillo. You go out of Ateneo.
You're right. Nobody writes
Yeah. We'll wait for Lanzona to write it.
Right.
Well, it's an interesting book, but it also
has a national narrative, but much more.
I was referring to them as the most popular textbooks in the country.
Yeah, and lack of resources from that. But historians don't think that way. Everybody you know who is a historian don't prescribe to this national narrative anymore.
Right, but they stop short of explaining it. Actually, the danger of saying 2 weeks ago I was in New York, a friend of mine who teaches at Columbia now, we had a small reunion of Filipino journalists, and we had dinner starting at 7. We ended up at 6 o'clock in the morning fighting over Mindanao. I mean, that kind of thing, actually, you're right. Some people are now saying, the Philippine history now is more complicated and more complex and all that. But the next step is to say, what now?
Right.
Do you then say to the Maguindanao and say, yeah, you're right, there's no Filipinos here, we're actually not Filipinos.
Yes.
The next step is, how do you write that? How do you explain that?
Yes.
In an educational system that says, no, you Muslims, 3 pages. I'm aware of the dynamism here in places like Hawaii, in institutions like Wisconsin and the CPS. But once you go to the field, you have to explain these things. And then I'm just trying to say, okay, how can I explain Mindanao to this farmer in Cotabato? But hey, you're Filipino. Don't worry. Right, but no, that's still national history. You're still, as a scholar, Lilia probably tell me. I've always seen myself as a teaching in an academe, but also engaging in constant conversations with ordinary folks. When I go to Mindanao, I don't announce it, I go to the marketplace. In the sense that you're learning from them, but you're also teaching them. And this actually is really an attempt to say, this is how I deal with things. It's a very difficult, this is what happens. The trauma of writing about history. Sorry. I'm going to dig later.
I have a kind of short question. Listening to you talk about the South, in terms of, I guess, the problem or the threat to the nation state of the Philippines, do you see the location that has been now more of an agent than being Muslim? Or which part of it, is it the religious identity, or is it the location that makes this problematic with being part of the nation?
The Muslims have always been there. I mean, 52% of Filipinos in the Philippines still say Muslims are not to be trusted. Okay. Every time I say, I'm from Mindanao, oh, you're Muslim. That's really a very popular thing. So there's the ethno-religious factor in it. Don't trust them, they're Muslims. But there is also reciprocated by, don't worry, nobody will see your book, there's no Filipinos here. But the other side, and it's very, in the last 10 years it's been developing, is the grandchildren of the settlers of Filipinos, of Ilocanos, Visayans, Cebuanos, Ilonggos in the Philippines, who now regard themselves as Mindanaoans, who we are from this island. And one of the things that's characterized this island is the economic exploitation and military oppression coming from Imperial Manila. I was so surprised last year when the mayor of Davao City actually said, in public, the mayor said, maybe it's time for us to separate. So there is that sentiment that's growing on. One of the positive things about it is these guys now reaching out to Muslim and Lumad leaders, non-Muslim indigenous communities, and saying, can we write our own history? What is our history as a people now? Where did my grandfather come from? And how did we become Mindanaoans? And that is happening under the radar, Vina, of Ateneo and UP. And that is still in the level of the oral. Mainly because people have no access to newspapers. It's very expensive to have the Philippine Daily Inquirer subscribe. So everything is oral there. And it's beginning in the two things. One, in the case of the Muslim communities, all these old MNLF guerrillas saying, let me tell you my story on how I went to the war, because I want my grandchild to know about this. And the sense of the children of the grandfather, the settler community is this: I'd like to understand why my father and mother moved, and why they did not go back to Cebu, rather stay in Mindanao. So it's all oral. It's a fascinating process that's going on now, being done by public intellectuals, NGO activists, and you know, institutions like CPS can really play a big role in recovering the stories, which will further complicate things. Sorry, Mim.
I have a question going beyond the writing of history. I'm thinking about the making and maybe unmaking of a nation. And following up on Leonard's question, to what extent are the current events to do with being rooted in the way the Philippines emerged under American colonial rule, and the fact that except for the early turn of the century, you know, the war against, after the Spanish opposition, the war against the Americans, but there was no real independent struggle that they had, for example, in the So what does that do to the idea of a nation that's not rooted in struggles against another?
Yeah, very big. I think in Al Mugay's new book now, actually, he methodically explained how the police, the Philippine Constabulary under American rule, just systematically destroyed any national opposition in Manila and the nearby provinces, which means then the national leadership, the putative national leadership that you could have developed there, who would have continued the 1896 revolution, the war against America, is destroyed. And the second thing that the Americans did, very typically Gilded Age American mentality, is to say, okay, let's go to the different provinces and engage in this give and take. Let's turn datos into congressmen, and you know how American congressmen and congresswomen operate. You know, the local is important. And bring them all to the National Assembly and teach them the art of, you know, machine politics. I mean, a lot of the governor generals, with the exception of Wood, 1930, were Tammany Hall politicians. You know.
And what about the fact that there was no independent struggle?
No, there was an attempt to revive that through the Communist Party in 1930, and that was immediately destroyed. Mm-hmm. So all these efforts for popular mobilization with a nationalist sentiment were either destroyed by the state, or in the case of the Communist Party in the 70s and 80s, which I remove here, it actually fell into the curse of localism. The Communist Party of the Philippines expanded considerably in the 80s, became a national revolutionary movement, but collapsed after 86. And people say, well, why did it collapse? One of the reasons was the three biggest regional committees of the organization began to think of them as local. The Mindanao Commission, for example, the party's strong, biggest organization, said, well, Mindanao is the center of the revolution, not Manila anymore. So it panicked the national leadership. So that was one thing that, you know, every effort to build a national movement either was destroyed by the military, the state, the local warlords, or fell in its own weaknesses. The young kid.
What's the response?
Follow up on me.
So it's about the you know, like what you said. How do you reconcile the anti-Manila imperialism in Mindanao and the pro-Americanism?
Well, the...
So, for example, yes. There is America is also something in the past, you know, in America. I mean, you say, go to America now and want to be in favor of America. They'll be discounted, neglected. You know, I mean, America doesn't care about them.
Well, we should, yeah.
But then, you know, they have all this in terms of internal and regional conflict, or, you know, lack of resources. They still look to the national government, right? In fact, they sometimes ask for
the local politicians. Yeah.
The local politicians. No, but anyway, this is my question in terms of how they're very nationalist in a way that they're anti-Manila imperialism, but at the same time, as you said, they're pro-America.
The immediate answer to that is a lot of these Muslim communities view the presence of American troops as a buffer against the Philippine army. Okay? It's not colonial mentality. The fact that if you have an American soldier there, that colonel over there will not send his troops to my village and kill us all. That's the first thing. The second thing is, given the corruption and weakness of the national government, the kind of aid, economic assistance these communities have been receiving are not coming from the Filipinos, they're coming from non-Filipinos. So at the end of the day, you say, who do I like? The Americanos with his, you know, war on terror thing, but he gives me, you know, he provides me my corn and allows me to keep my gun, by the way. Or the Philippine government, which sends its army to rape our women and kill us all. So that is something that is refused, that Manila refuses to recognize. I'm sorry.
Any other questions?
It's a comment, I guess, more so than a question. Or maybe you can turn it into a question for me. But it seems common for people to really conflate Mindanao and Sulu.
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be delinked.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You were explaining about the sort of the origins of being Mindanaoan and Abetsabuana this and Ilocano that. That's just completely absent, really, from the Sulu experience. That there isn't that in-migration, that history of in-migration. And I wonder, kind of related to what Vina was saying, you know, the narrative I'm thinking it's more what you're getting at is we need to really rethink the framework, not so much the narrative. The narrative will follow the framework.
Yeah, precisely.
So, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
That can be a good dissertation topic. Now, as I said to Professor Aquino, I agonize with this. Today I'm a separatist, tomorrow I'm a nationalist. Yeah. So younger people like you probably can help solve it for us. Thank you. Thank you very much for your questions.
Mahalo for listening to the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series podcast. If you'd like to download, comment on, or share this podcast, as well as subscribe to our weekly announcement listserv,